Hi, I'm Bradley Brownell, and you're listening to the first ever episode of 10 and 2, the show that helps you get a grip on the world of cars. Each week, I'll bring you an interesting story about cars, and you bring me your questions. So check out the show, and if you want to learn something, geek out about weird car trivia, or hear crazy stories from automotive history, this is the place. You'll love it. I'll love it. We'll all have fun. We'll become friends. Listen to the show every other week on KWNK in Reno, Jalopnik.com, all over the world, or download the show wherever you get your podcasts. You may be wondering who I am and where I earned the credentials to be preaching to you about cars. Quite honestly, I'm wondering the same thing. The fact is, I just love cars. A lot. Like, my entire life. I've been writing about cars professionally for 15 years, and I've been part of the Jalopnik.com team reporting about all things automotive for 3 years. I've driven and reviewed hundreds of cars. I have far too many cars of my own, and usually at least one of them is broken. I learned to fix my own cars, trucks, and motorcycles because I couldn't afford the repair bills, and it's easier that way. Maybe not easier. Hopefully I can transfer some of that wisdom onto you. You can find my written work every day at Jalopnik.com, which is definitively the greatest car site in the world. I also run the show at FlatSixes.com, a blog about Porsches, and I have a weekly electric car column at EVPulse.com. I'm also one of the co-founders of Radwood, an automotive festival celebrating everything radical to come out of the 1980s and 1990s. This week, I'm going to be bringing you the story of inexpensive American chickens. Chickens? I thought this was a car show. Don't worry, we'll get there. In part, American slavery in the Southeast is responsible for chicken becoming the staple of cuisine that it is today. You see, there were laws in the American South preventing slaves from owning their own large livestock, like cattle or pigs. Wealthy landowning Americans of the day did not consider fowl to be worthy of their palate and allowed slaves to grow the birds for their own consumption. Not only did these birds prove that chicken was a viable meal meat, but the black community developed decades and generations of recipes for crafting the perfect chicken plates. During the Civil War era, Gordonsville, Virginia was among the most hopping places in the South, as two major train lines stopped in the city's depot. Gordonsville was a commerce hub. There were all kinds of trade going on in that area at the time. People would bring all of their goods from the area, from all over the South, really, to Gordonsville for transport on these major train lines. In addition to goods, these trains carried passengers en masse. In those days, train travel didn't offer a dinner car, and passengers were often quite peckish by the time they got to Gordonsville. Entrepreneurial black women began cooking and selling battered and golden fried chicken to travelers on the train platform. They were known as waiter carriers. The waiter carriers proved that chicken was not only delicious, but also it could be profitable. So that made a business out of chicken. Post-emancipation, the Gordonsville Train Depot chicken fryers continued to deliver deliciousness all the way up to the 1930s. Family recipes for fried chicken have been passed down through generations, and Gordonsville is still known today for top-quality chicken chefs. Technological advancements in chicken farming, such as vitamin D to allow the chickens to grow healthy in the middle of winter, the artificial incubator to allow chickens to produce eggs at a much higher rate, and the proliferation of antibiotics to reduce chickens dying of preventable disease, Americans had greater access to chicken than ever before, year-round even. As a result, demand increased and supply had to grow to keep a pace and keep prices low. Chicken farming boomed all over the U.S. A major change in chickens' fate came during World War II, when the United States instituted rationing on the staples of the American dining table. Red meats were severely rationed to aid the war effort, while chicken and Spam didn't require a ration stamp to purchase. Demand shot through the roof on chicken, and it became a daily institution of the American family. That is, until the war ended and rationing ended in 1945. Through all of this, chicken was still significantly more expensive per pound to grow and market than large red meat livestock. In order to ease the chicken industry's woes as post-war demand waned, the government put up a challenge to chicken growers. Create the super chicken of the future to boost growing efficiencies. The aim was to breed a bird that would not only grow in size in less time, but have more meat on the bone. There was a $5,000 cash prize for the nation's most plump and efficient growing birds. Prior to this, chicken was seen as a scrawny meal and could hardly feed a family. The chicken of the future delivered an American-sized meal to the dinner table, and it exploded in popularity. The chicken industry boomed, and huge vertically integrated companies like Tyson and Purdue took off like rockets. Pound for pound, chicken prices plummeted, and Gallus gallus domesticus became the cheapest source of meat in the U.S. Okay, so let's recap. American-grown chicken is cheaper and more efficient than ever before in history. What does that have to do with cars? Thanks for sticking with me. We're almost there. On the other side of the Atlantic, in France and West Germany, for example, the appetite for chicken had developed in a decidedly very different manner. The birds were still farmed in small quantities, and they were still the scrawny birds that were sold in Europe as delicacies. Then the American chickens invaded and completely upended the market. By the 1960s, the American industrial chicken farms were responsible for more than half of all chickens sold in Europe, and chicken consumption increased along with it. In an effort to save their domestic chicken production industry, France initially instituted a massive tariff on imported chickens to keep prices high and their local farms profitable. West Germany and other European Economic Community members, Luxembourg, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Italy, followed after. Accusations were made that American chicken producers were dumping chicken in Europe below cost to drive domestic production out of business. American chicken hormones were damaging to the men of France claimed, and that these birds were being fed unsafe levels of arsenic to promote muscle growth. The resulting loss of European sales due to this tariff cost the American poultry industry an estimated $28 million by 1962, which is what we call in the business quite a lot. That's Americans losing money because of tariffs that Europe instituted to save their own chicken industry. After several months of attempts at finding a diplomatic solution to what was then known as the Chicken War, nobody would meet in the middle, and the American chicken industry was hurting without its steady exports. In retaliation for the EEC's tariff, President Lyndon B. Johnson pushed through a tax on goods imported from Europe in December of 1963. The initial idea was a heavy 25% tariff on things like potato starch, the chemical dextrin, and after-dinner digestif brandy. This alone would have been significant, but a fateful meeting with the president of the United Auto Workers Union would have long-lasting consequences. Here's where we start talking about cars. The many different flavors of Volkswagen's iconic van had become highly sought after throughout the early 1960s. These vans were reliable, inexpensive, and fuel-efficient compared to the competition. The Type 2 van, as it was called, was offered in a variety of commercial van and pickup configurations for farmers or businesses to carry their goods. It offered an excellent alternative to the big American pickup trucks and full-sized vans of the day. As a result, these vans and trucks were selling like hotcakes, cribbing sales from Ford, Dodge, and Chevrolet all over the country. President Johnson was facing re-election in 1964 and desperately wanted to avoid a UAW strike to keep the economy from failing under his tenure. In a meeting with UAW President Walter Reuther, Johnson proposed a quid pro quo. If Reuther would prevent his union from striking, the president would include light truck imports in his retaliatory tariff on Europe, effectively killing the Volkswagen van's sales bonanza. The deal was struck, truck imports were taxed 25%, and LBJ got his re-election. President Johnson's tariff came to be known as the chicken tax. It forced importers like Volkswagen to pay a 25% import tax to the U.S. government for every light truck or commercial van it brought into the country. That tax increased the price of the van, and it was no longer competitively priced with American-made options. Because this applied to all imported vans and trucks, the Japanese automakers were hit equally by this, despite not having any qualms with the U.S. chicken industry. 1964, light truck and commercial van imports tanked to about a third of what it had been the prior year. And by 1965, the import brands were practically gone from the American market altogether. Without the stiff competition of the smaller, lighter, easier to drive, and more fuel-efficient import pickups and vans, Detroit automakers were no longer required to keep pace with the innovation of foreign brands. While this did protect the big three automakers in the short term, the increased competition might have forced them to develop trucks and vans more in line with what American car buyers had proven they wanted in the early 1960s. Famously, some automakers have tried to circumvent the chicken tax through crafty methods over the years. You may know about the Subaru Brat, compact pickup of the late 1970s that was sold through the 1980s. The Japanese company installed plastic jump seats in the bed of that truck. They could then claim that it was a four-seat car with alfresco seating for two. Ford's first-generation Transit Connect van was imported to the U.S. from the company's plant in Turkey with full passenger-spec interiors to get around the commercial van tax. Once they arrived in port in Philadelphia, the vans had their vestigial back seats ripped out and shredded. Chrysler's Ram brand still does this today with their ProMaster City compact van. Perhaps most egregiously, Mercedes-Benz shipped all of the parts to build a Sprinter van to a facility in the U.S. where they were then assembled into van shape. The chicken tax was not applicable to the parts, only to complete vans. In the intervening years since the chicken tax was enacted, the United States market has become a veritable breeding ground for domestic pickup truck sales. Ford's F-150 is perennially leading the way in unit sales, and Chevrolet's Silverado and Chrysler's Ram aren't that far behind. An international trade expert at Harvard Business, Robert Lawrence, proposed in 2009 that the near death of the Big Three was owed to the 1964 chicken tax. By insulating the American truck market from any kind of serious competition over the previous 40 years, wrote Lawrence, profits remained high and innovation stagnated. Resting on the prodigious profits of their full-size trucks, American manufacturers paid little attention to their sedans and compact commuter cars. This allowed import brands to completely take over that space with more efficient, more reliable, and better assembled units. The economic recession of 2008 nearly killed the Big Three and possibly would have if it weren't for the large-scale government bailout of GM and Chrysler. The chicken tax may have been a short-term positive for American truck and commercial van makers, but after nearly 50 years, this protectionary action from LBJ has come with the unforeseen effect of bigger and more expensive trucks. But that's a discussion for another time. So, there you have it. Is any other show going to give you the through line between the eating habits of slaves and the current state of the pickup truck market? I don't think so. That's what 10 and 2 is for. Okay, so we're going to move on to the question and answers segment of the show. A lot of you have responded very well and given me a bunch of stuff to work with here. So for the very first show, we've got a bunch of questions to answer, so we're going to kick that off right here. Our first question comes from Annie here in the KWNK studio. She asks, is warming up your car real? Especially here in Reno, where temperatures in the winter are getting overnight very cold. We've already had some frozen nights. It, you know, some of you might be warming up your car before you take off in the morning. Warming up your car is a real thing, but you can have too much of a good thing. So when you get into your car in the morning, you probably want to start it up, let it idle for a while, and, you know, turn on the seat heaters and adjust your radio and all that. Probably by the time you get all of that done, your engine is now warm enough that you could drive away. Give it 2 to 3 minutes, and that's all you really need. There are cars, you know, people use their remote to start their car and let it idle for 15 to 20 minutes, probably while they get coffee ready or take a shower or whatever. You don't need to let it go that long, and that actually might be harmful to your car. So on extremely cold mornings, say anything below freezing, 32 degrees Fahrenheit, you probably want to idle your car for a few minutes before taking off. The oil in your car's engine is used to lubricate all of the components inside, so think of that like syrup or honey. Obviously, it doesn't flow as well when it's really cold. You don't have to get the engine super hot, and actually leaving it to idle in very cold temperatures for more than a few minutes can have a detrimental effect to the engine's longevity. Engine oil usually runs between 230 and 260 degrees, but warming up your engine means getting it to 60 or 70 degrees, just warm enough to get that thick oil warm enough to flow. It is important to reference your car's owner's manual to confirm what kind of oil you need, particularly if you live in a climate where winter is typically below freezing, like we do here in Reno. Many manufacturers recommend a different viscosity of oil in the engine depending on the average ambient temperature. So you may have a winter oil and a summer oil. DSF underscore Fernando on Twitter asks, how do you choose a car under, in his case, 2,000 euros because he's riding from Europe? But it's a good question pretty much anywhere. How do you buy a good and cheap car that won't leave you stranded? It's a really important question, especially in these economically variable times that we're in right now. If you're looking for a good, cheap car, how do you do it? Well, that's a tough question. The problem with that is there are so many variables on a good, cheap, used car. Cheap cars typically are, these days, at least 10 years old. So you're looking at something that's probably got six figures numbers on the odometer and probably has been through a few owners. When you get a car that's been through a few owners, you probably have reached the point where someone may have neglected that car, let's say. This is definitely a case where you don't want to judge a book by its cover. A really nice-looking car on the outside can hide a bunch of problems on the inside. If it hasn't been maintained, if it hasn't had all of the things replaced that need to be replaced, you might be buying something that'll cost you a lot of money down the road. And I know that if you're looking for a $2,000 car, you probably don't have a lot of money to throw at it. So the best thing to do is to invest a little bit of money up front to get that car inspected before you buy it. It might cost you a couple $100s, which I know is a lot of money, but it could save you a lot of money in the long term. I recommend this to anyone, especially people who aren't enthusiasts, who don't know how to look for those things that are wrong with a car. You could take it to really any shop and say, I would like to perform a pre-purchase inspection. Get a glossing over of what's wrong with the car before you decide to buy it. Chances are you're not going to know what might go wrong with a specific example without doing a ton of research, without doing a lot of your own work. So it could have something like a timing belt that's ready to blow up. And if the timing belt goes 10 miles after you buy the car, now you've got a really expensive paperweight. So it's tough. Sometimes you're buying on a wing and a prayer. Generally, I'll say this, generally buy the nicest, compact Japanese car that you can find, a Honda Civic, a Honda Accord, a Toyota Camry, Toyota Corolla, Mazda 3, those kinds of things. They're probably going to be good enough to last you a while and don't have major detrimental issues on the used market at huge high mileage. It's a tough question. The rough part is you're gambling when you buy any car, really. I hope that answers that a little bit. At ScoobyDoDo9 on Twitter says, paying for a car that I'd like to buy but can't afford. How do I do that? Well, I'm going to be Susie Orman here and say, don't buy a car that you can't afford. There are all kinds of dealers that are willing to offer you huge, long lead times on paying back your car. Say, 60-month or 72-month loan. I don't really recommend doing that unless you can get a really, really good interest rate by doing it, but chances are pretty low. So realistically, don't focus on the monthly payment. Focus on how much money you can afford to have tied up in a car. The big problem with cars is you could have a huge loan on a car and the value of that car depreciates as soon as you drive it off the lot. You may lose a bunch of money on a car you can't afford. Yeah. So you could still be at John BC Jr. on Twitter. Says, how do you install a CD player in my 2020 Mazda 3? Oh, no. John, I'm afraid that's probably not going to be available to you unless perhaps you could go to a stereo shop and have them install like an old school disc changer in the trunk or the back hatch, whatever it may be. You don't specify it, so it's a sedan or a hatch. But the problem is, in the old days, there used to be a standard for your radio in the dash. It used to be called DIN, D-I-N. It stands for Deutsches Institut für Normung. Basically, the DIN was a stereo slot in your dash that the radio would go into, and it was standardized across the industry. And this was from the, you know, heady days of the 50s all the way up through maybe 10 years ago. There was this standard of everything from 8-tracks to cassettes to CDs. They were always the same size. And many cars today obviously don't have CD players, which is probably why you're asking how to install one in your Mazda 3. Those systems no longer have a DIN standard. They've gone to big screens, and they've integrated them more smoothly into the dash surfaces. The Mazda 3, for instance, has a little screen tacked onto the top of the dash that sticks up like maybe like a tombstone above the dash. So you're not going to be able to replace that. And there's nowhere in the dash to fit a DIN stereo. So you're kind of out of luck there. Like I said, you might be able to get a CD changer maybe installed in your glove box or under the passenger seat or maybe in the back hatch. But I honestly don't know. I haven't got the answer for you there. The right pedal on Jalopnik.com says, on behalf of my non-enthusiast friend, she just bought a 2007 Volkswagen Rabbit with the 2.5-liter five-cylinder, 95,000 miles. This is real life, not theoretically. No service records to speak of aside from oil change. Runs great, turns great, stops great. She doesn't want to bug me about every maintenance sort of thing. I just got this car. Where should I start? What should I check or do? So, there are a few things you can do here. The first thing that I would do is check the owner's manual for the service schedule. Obviously, without any information from the previous owner on whether any of these services were done, you're going to have to assume that none of them were done. Many people neglect these things, which can cause long-term issues. Cars are built from a bunch of different systems that work together, and something like a bad ball joint can cost you a lot of money in premature tire wear, for example. So the Volkswagen Rabbit's service schedule for the 100,000-mile service recommends inspecting a lot of things, which should be done at every service, and performing fluid changes. And one of the interesting things is it recommends lubricating the sunroof slides. So that's one thing that gets overlooked a lot. If you have a sunroof car, you're probably going to want to lubricate those sunroof slides. The things like the ball joints and stuff, really you only replace those if they are bad or if they look like they're about to go bad. So that's what an inspection can do for you. So if you have a car with high mileage that you've purchased with no records, like I mentioned earlier, you can get a pre-purchase inspection. You could also get a post-purchase inspection. You've already bought the car, but you want to know what's wrong with it. Take it to a shop. It'll cost you a couple of hours of labor. They'll tell you, hey, we found this, we found that. You know, those are the things. Major things that people overlook on older cars or cars that don't have service records, I would recommend brake fluid flush. That's one that most people don't do. Brake fluid is hygroscopic, which means that it absorbs water. So it gets less effective over time as it absorbs water out of the air. So generally, you're recommended to replace your brake fluid every year. Most people don't do that, but it is recommended. So yeah, that's my recommendation. If you have a car and you're not an enthusiast, you're not doing the service work on the car yourself or the inspection work on the car yourself, take it to any local shop and they could probably tell you more about it. SmalleyXB112 on Jalopnik says, I like the idea, but the name is generally considered out of date in the era of airbags. Granted, 9 and 3 doesn't evoke the same idea of driving. And I agree. It's called 10 and 2 because despite the name of the show, that's how people learned to drive. They said, hold the wheel at 10 and 2. Cars with airbags, now if you hold the wheel at 10 and 2, the airbag blows up and you're now punching yourself in the face or breaking your arm on the airbag. So generally the rule has been changed to drive at 9 and 3, which is where the spokes are on the steering wheel. So you put your thumbs on the spokes. So the idea here is not only is 10 and 2 evocative of the driving experience, but it's a learning experience. You can learn from the name of the show, and that's what the show is. So, yes, you don't drive at 10 and 2 anymore. You drive at 9 and 3. 10 and 2 is the name of the show, but you're learning not to drive at 10 and 2 by listening to the show, right? Anyway, BFJones1142 on Jalopnik.com says, one of the more satisfying driving experiences is flashing your brights at a truck trying to merge ahead of you and getting the flash back once they've safely merged. Are there any other forms of intercar communication you can think of, and should there be more? Yeah, there's all kinds of intercar communication. I can think of a few that when you're angry, you might use a finger or two. but personally, I always appreciate a friendly wave. Here in the West, there's a lot of two-lane roads that have pullouts. So slower cars, if there's a line of cars behind you, can pull out and get past without having to go into the other lane, because on a mountain road, you never know when there's going to be somebody coming around the bend. So the best thing is when you're driving or riding a motorcycle behind a slower car and they pull out, you can give them a little wave. And hopefully they understand that you appreciate them pulling out to give you that right of way. I also like a little horn honk. Not the big lay on your horn, I'm mad at you, but just a beep. Just a little beep. That's nice. It's every once in a while. It's just like you're trying to merge in, somebody lets you in, give them a little beep as a thank you. Honestly, there should be two kinds of horn. There should be an angry horn and a nice horn. I think that's a good idea. Car makers, get on that ASAP. Double horn. Call it the Brad horn. Catback Exhaust on Jalopnik.com says, why are manual shift transmissions in cars not sequential like they are in motorcycles? I've seen this in rally cars and always wondered why this wasn't a thing in passenger vehicles. So for the people who are listening who don't know what a sequential transmission is, basically the manual shift gears are all lined up in a row. So you've got first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and you move through those gears by bumping a lever forward or backward. And then there's more modern advancements have made that so that it's electronically controlled through paddles on the steering wheel. So you've got an upshift paddle and a downshift paddle. The major reason why this isn't done is because of something called noise, vibration, and harshness. Cars are tested on NVH, and sequential manuals are both noisy, and they provide a harsh shift adjustment. So you're in a race car, comfort doesn't really matter. You're all about going faster. So they don't really care whether it's buzzy or loud, or the shift is very abrupt. So you could have a very like slam kind of shift. So manual transmissions, they have clutches to avoid this, and the shift is made very smooth and all of that. Automatics obviously don't do this. And then the biggest reason that sequentials never caught on was because dual clutch gearboxes exist now. So many sportier cars, let's say, use a dual clutch transmission, which has usually paddles on the steering wheel like a sequential, but uses clutches to avoid that abrupt change in gear. And the gears are not stacked on the same sequential gearbox. So it's kind of minutiae and it's kind of over the head of non-enthusiasts. So I won't get too deep into this, but the main reason that you don't have sequential in a car is that it's loud, it's uncomfortable. So hopefully that answers your question. Steve Kang on Jalopnik's Facebook page says, what is the actual proper seating position for street driving? This is a good one. I see a lot of people, they're either leaning too far back, they're sitting too low, they're sitting too high. You really want to get a good position that is not only comfortable, but allows you to control the car in a good way. So the first thing that you need to know, probably the biggest thing, is your seat should be placed in a way that your hips are level with your knees. You want that to happen. That's just going to give you the best comfort level, especially for a long road trip where you don't want your knees above your hips. And you don't want your knees to be hanging off the edge of the seat. So you want them to be well supported, but you also want them to be in line with your hips. You can tilt your backrest just slightly around 100 degrees, so just a little bit past 90, to get the best comfort. So you're not getting the spinal jarring of sitting straight upright. You know, if you hit a pothole or something, not only is your suspension absorbing that bump, but your spine is absorbing that bump. If you're tilted back just a little bit, then the seat is absorbing that bump rather than the entirety of your spine. So that's just a comfort thing and a longevity thing. You want to be able to fully depress the brake pedal and the gas pedal. So you adjust your seat so that it's far enough forward for your feet to reach. You want to be able to go all the way down. If you're coming up on an accident and you panic stop and you don't have enough pedal travel on that brake pedal to get stopped or to stop fast enough, then that could be really detrimental, not only to your car, but to yourself. You can get in an accident pretty easily. So you want to be far enough forward that your feet will reach the floor. If possible, you want to be close enough to the steering wheel to drape your wrists over the top of the wheel. You want to be able to put your arms out and fold your hands over the top of the steering wheel. So that action, being able to do that, it gives you enough range of motion to turn the wheel without having to reach straight out. Your arms should always be bent when you grab the wheel, not outstretched with locked elbows. So maybe that that'll help you understand how to sit in a car to be not only comfortable but to control it to the utmost of your abilities. So there you go. VB in NV on Jalopnik.com says, if I get new shocks and or struts on a carefully driven car with 83,000 miles, for instance, my 2014 Mazda 3, will I notice a difference? So, shock absorbers are the thing that, it's kind of a misnomer. A shock absorber is more of a damper. Your springs in the car are what really absorb the bump or the pothole or whatever. And then the dampers, the shock absorbers and the struts, they help even out that spring force. So they pull you back down basically. So if you were just to have springs and no shocks, you would hit a bump and your car would just keep bouncing, you know, like a bouncy ball. It's got that expandable energy in there, and the metal spring coil, or however your springs are, you know, twist beam axle or whatever, is going to compress and then come back up, and then it's going to slowly level out through four or five undulations. So having that shock absorber in there, it's a tube filled with fluid that helps dampen that bounce. So you're going to hit the bump, and the spring will absorb the bump, and then it'll even it out with the shock absorber. So the fluid in those dampers is meant to last between 50 and 100,000 miles on average, depending on the car and depending on the manufacturer. It's likely that on a well-maintained and carefully driven car, you probably wouldn't notice a difference if you replaced the shock absorbers, unless you had two identical cars, one with worn shocks and one with brand new replaced shocks, and drove them back to back. You're probably going to get it, it's going to be several hours apart. If you're doing it yourself or having a shop do it, whatever, replacing all four shocks and struts is going to take a while. So even if you drive it to the shop, have them do it, and then drive it back home, you're probably not going to notice the difference, because there's going to be that gap in time where you weren't driving the car, and you'll get back in the car and everything else will feel the same. The steering wheel feels the same. The seat feels the same. But with new shock absorbers, you probably won't notice that difference, especially if you're replacing it with a stock shock absorber. It's probably going to feel about the same. That said, worn shock absorbers can contribute to a less responsive car and increase your braking distances by a few feet. It could be the difference between stopping short and plowing into the back of somebody. So I would say, you may not notice a difference, but there is a difference. So at 80,000 miles, you might be okay for a little while longer, but it's definitely time to start thinking about it. Maybe get them on order, talk to a shop about getting an appointment, that kind of thing. I would recommend eventually getting those replaced. Lars on Jalopnik.com says, do airbags ever expire? I have a 12-year-old Mazda 3. Hey, it's Mazda 3 show. That runs great, and the only thing I wonder about is if the airbags will still work as expected. One reason I would get a new car is that safety concern. Yes and no. As with everything, there is yeses and nos. The short answer is, you're probably fine. The main issue with an airbag getting old is the igniter module, which is also known as a squib, in case you didn't know that. The squib can fail if it gets wet, so it would lose the effectiveness of the igniting process. So if you get in a crash, it won't ignite and it won't push the airbag out to help save you. Most squibs are sealed in a fashion called glass to metal. This is going back to the 1970s when airbags were first kind of invented. It's a pretty robust seal, and it's unlikely that water will get in there. Some early airbag cars used a plastic to metal barrier, which is less effective at getting water, keeping the water out, but not totally ineffective. Most cars, I've mentioned a few times the service schedule of your car. If you go through and look at the service schedule of your car, it may have airbags on the inspection list, or it may have even replacement of the airbags on that service schedule list. So if your safety restraint systems light, the SRS light on your dash, is still doing what it's supposed to, usually that means when you start the car, it turns on for a little bit and then extinguishes, you're probably good. That's the car's self-diagnostics saying, this system works, the igniter isn't wet, we're good. But if you have concerns, you can visit your local dealer and they can inspect the system to see if it's still working correctly. Maybe they can tell you the answer. So back in 1992, to put maybe a little more of your fears at ease, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, the IIHS, crash tested a rusty 20-year-old Chevrolet. It was one of the first cars with an airbag, one of the first 2000, in fact. Both the driver and passenger airbags deployed correctly, according to the IIHS. So that's a 20-year-old rusty car. Admittedly, study was done almost 30 years ago now, but you can assume that if a 20-year-old Impala from the 70s airbag went off correctly 20 years later, that your 12-year-old car is more than likely fine. So, yeah. That said, some manufacturers like Mercedes-Benz put airbag replacements on their service schedule for cars built before 1998, and that wasn't a cheap replacement. So, but what do I know? None of my cars have airbags. They're all too old. So, that was our final question. What did you guys think of the show? I've got questions for you now. What do you want to hear? We'll have a phone line so you can call in and get that set up. That'll be fun. I can actually maybe on the next couple of episodes from now, I can put your voice on this radio station and I can answer your questions that way. In the meantime, hope you enjoyed this. Hope you enjoyed the story up front. Hope you enjoyed some of these answers. Hopefully you learned something. And if not, then maybe next time. 10 and 2 is hosted by me, Bradley Brownell. This episode was produced by Bradley Brownell, editing by Bradley Brownell and Annie Saunders. Promotional consideration from listeners like you has made this show possible. Please visit kwnkradio.org to support Reno Community Radio. Go to jalopnik.com to read, enjoy, and comment on all of my articles. Shout out to the Tappet Brothers. Thanks for listening. I'll see you around the bend.